This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Jane Borden intended to leave at least some of her southernness behind when she moved to Manhattan after graduating from UNC. A debutante raised in Greensboro, she longed to lose herself in the anonymity of New York life. She found out it wasn't so easy. Her journey from North Carolina to New York and back again is the subject of her new collection of essays, I Totally Meant to Do That. And Jane Borden is with us now. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You were raised in Greensboro. Did you have the sense that you were sort of being raised Southern? Sometimes people do. They know.
Well, I did have a moment of awareness. I mean, you know, reality is what is put in front of you. I didn't know there was a bigger world for a long time. I thought everyone gave raw sausage for Christmas.
Is that a Greensboro tradition? I'm not aware of that one.
My parents,
is it hanging on the tree?
Well, it would accidentally on occasion be put under the tree if people didn't know what it was, which would then, you know, as I say in the book, become on Christmas morning, you know, a truth far more disturbing than Santa. But there was a point, I guess, when I was growing up that I realized at least that I was being groomed for something, for the life of being a lady and
whatever that would involve. So then you went to UNC and majored in religious studies. Why? What were you going to do with that?
You know, I guess I realized pretty early on that I wouldn't apply my liberal arts education in any, you know, really concrete way. And so I thought, I just want to learn whatever fascinates me the most, and was drawn to that department. It's a wonderful hidden gem. Not to say that they don't get a lot of respect, because they do, but I loved it. And it was very diverse. I got to study, you know, one of my favorite classes was we read the book of Genesis from a literary perspective. It was technically an English class, and I loved that cross-disciplinarianism.
You see, so there's baptism and Southern baptism, and then Southern Presbyterian, all of those diverse religions. So, it is a diverse and it's a fascinating education, but then you decided to go to New York. Didn't you? Did you have family up there?
Well, my sister was living there at the time, and that definitely made, I guess, the idea of the transition a little easier in my mind. But as you said in the intro, I just wanted to disappear for a little while. And I'm not sure I knew at the time that that's what was happening, but subconsciously I think that's a universal feeling for a lot of 22-year-olds, is you run away from home as far and as fast as you can, and only later, hopefully, you get the wisdom to look back and go, oh, that place was pretty nice, actually.
What did you think you were going to do there?
I didn't know. I just took off, and I actually had 13 jobs in 4 years in the city because I didn't have a plan. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know I wanted to write or do comedy or any of that. I just kind of fell into it.
Now, one of those jobs was the secret shopper.
Yes.
Tell us about that. It's in the book and it's wonderful.
I worked for a private investigation company who busted counterfeiters in Chinatown. And we were a small middleman kind of organization. You know, customs obviously does a much bigger job of that than we do. But we, our clients were luxury goods purveyors like Chanel or Rolex. And my job was to pretend to shop. And actually, I would be finding out who was selling what and where it was in the store and reporting back that information. And most of the people who had the job were actors. It was an actor friend of mine who had told me about it. But I'm not really an actor. I'm horrible at it, in fact. And so I learned pretty quickly that if I just played an exaggerated version of myself, of the Southerner, of the Southern tourist, that it worked.
Why was that so? Why do you think?
It gave me a very clear illustration of how people actually perceive Southerners to be.
So you say exaggerated, so that would mean an accent.
Well, I
so
would
how
go
that
in
sound?
With an
Can
accent.
Can you give me a sample of that?
I would say, hey, y'all, you know, y'all got Gucci? That sort of thing. And I would pretend to talk on the phone so that I would have an opportunity to display this Southern persona. And I would pretend to be talking to my sister who was, you know, at the Lion King with the kids or at the Hershey store or whatever. And I would really amp it up. And they would just immediately dismiss me as guileless, as harmless. And I think a lot of people see Southerners that way. And I didn't mind at all using it against them.
So now, tell us exactly how this works. It's kind of interesting because you have to get them to sort of out the fact that they have. How does it work?
Well, they want to make sales. you know, it's in their best interest to have the items on display, because that is why so many people go down to Canal Street in Chinatown, is to buy fake goods. So they sell a lot of items that are anonymous, and sometimes they will have the contraband goods in the back hiding. Sometimes they'll have it out. So if it was hiding, I would have to play the game a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, I would know, first of all, that this particular salesperson was more suspicious than others or more worried. And so I would have to play the game and pretend to be a tourist and talk to them and ask if they'd have it. Sometimes they'd say no, or they'd look at mm-hmm. me cautiously. And
you'd have to say hush puppy or something.
Exactly. I'd just go, grits biscuit. And then they'd open the door.
Right. So you do that. Now what? I mean, so you find it. Or they pull out the phony Gucci. Now what?
Well, frequently I would buy something. I had a small budget, so just to avert suspicion. And then I would have to have all of this information going in my head. You know, I've said that this job should be something that, you know, older people do when they retire to stave off Alzheimer's. Excuse me. It was unbelievable the amount of information I had to keep in my head. You know, 7 bags in the right side, 2nd shelf from the top, right. You know, that times 12 for whatever else was in the store, times 5 stores, until I could get to a bathroom and purge my brain into a notebook.
And then what? Is there a raid? And does it happen? Does it happen that day? Or?
There would be a raid. Yes, typically on the weekends, because it was off-duty cops and firemen who worked there. And this company is now defunct. I say that I wouldn't be spilling all this information if they were still operating. But off-duty cops and firemen participated in the raid just because of their heft mm-hmm. and experience.
Yeah, yeah. And so they got axes, the firemen. And that helps.
And they, you know, they would come in the big truck and use the hoses. No, it's not true. But it would always be on a weekend for that, because right. of that. And so right. the counterfeiters knew that they could only ever get busted on the weekends. I mean, everybody kind of knew what everyone else was up to, but we still got work done. And
there's some crazy things that happen, because if they think that something's up, they'll just like shut down the store.
Exactly.
Maybe you win it.
I got locked in several stores, and I would have to keep up the ruse, even though I knew the guys waiting outside.
Right.
I would have to pretend like I didn't know what was happening, which meant freaking out. That part was really fun. I'd bang on the door and go, "What's happening?"
Because apparently they would pull down the metal gate, right, and keep you in there. So apparently getting caught with phony goods is a lot worse than, say, kidnapping, which
right.
didn't seem to matter so much in New York.
Right. Wow. Exactly.
How'd you get that job?
A friend of mine at a bar who was an actor. I had started taking improv comedy classes. I went to see an improv comedy show and thought, I want to do that. And I signed up for classes. And so then I met a lot of actors that way. And he had actually applied for the job, but he couldn't get it because he had a felony on his record. And we were associated with the police station.
Yeah.
And so I got fingerprinted and they did a background check and everything on me. It was very exciting. It made me feel I'd led such a sheltered life, you know.
And did you have any fake, you know, expensive stuff that, you know,
I didn't. And after working that job, I've never been interested in it.
Jane Borden's my guest. I Totally Meant to Do That is her collection of essays talking about her journey from Greensboro to New York and back to North Carolina. When you first moved to New York, you experienced a particularly southern ailment, a form of jaw pain.
Yes. It took me a while to figure out what was happening. But after a few days, I realized that it's because I was smiling at everyone just on instinct. And, you know, in the South, we do that, and mm-hmm. and we can. We have the luxury of doing that because there aren't that many of us, but there are about 15 to 20 right. people per block in New York, and I was kind of bobbing my head around to catch all of them. I must have looked like a maniac. I'd say that if I was a man, I would have been maced. but I realized after I figured it out because a woman gave me this weird look, like, mm. what are you doing? And then I realized I had been smiling at her. But then I immediately remembered the last time I'd had that pain in my jaws, which was after my debutante ball, when we had the receiving line and the same thing, like,
Your Aunt Jane plays a very important part in these stories. Tell us about her.
Well, she's my mother's sister, and she is a very proper Southern lady that you think of when you think of that. You know, she plays bridge, and she has the house full of silver and the yard full of roses, and she was always in charge of my etiquette training as a child. I mean, my parents were too, but she had a real vested interest. And I was always on recital and on display and being critiqued, my etiquette. Yeah. It was as if being watched by a hawk, except without the eventual relief of being eaten by it. And when I went to New York, she was not happy about that.
Uh-uh.
And she would call and say things like, come home, I'm terrified you'll marry a Yankee, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But she eventually, I came to understand her constant knockings on the door is not a passive-aggressive way of criticizing me, but it's her way of reaching out to me and trying to remind me where I come from.
And protecting you from the predations of Yankees, which is noble. She also, not only did she knock on the door, she sent you gifts, as you write about in Staring a Gift Horse in the Mouth.
She sent me a lot of presents, and because I didn't have a doorman, she had to send them to the office, which meant that she became famous in the office for these things. She would send me like a paisley print shower cap. Because everyone needs one of those. To the office this went. And so every time a package came, the friends, because we have an open office, and they would see it and they would stand by me while I opened it. And then, of course, one time what happened is I had been home recently and had forgotten to bring a slip. And we were going to church and I borrowed my sister's dress and you could see the Holy Trinity. And she was horrified that I didn't have enough slips or that, God forbid, I wasn't wearing them.
Well,
in New
how did
York.
Jane even find out about that horrible episode?
Well, because she was standing behind me.
Oh, she was
when
there.
I was
she
home.
Was there for this.
So she sent, me an etiquette book to the office. And when I opened it, she had highlighted parts in pink.
I see. Now, you apparently felt comfortable enough opening these things at work.
Well, I did. I think if I had known what that one was, I might have waited.
Where were you working at the time?
I worked for a magazine called Time Out New York, and that was my 13th job that I have held on to for the last 6 years.
And you were doing interviews as part of some of your work up there involved interviewing and talking with comedians.
That's true. I cover comedy. It's my beat in New York, and it's such a fun beat. I get to review sketch groups and interview, you know, Ricky Gervais or Christopher Guest when they come to town, and it's been really fun.
That's a lot of fun. And you've done some comedy writing. You wrote for SNL, right?
Yes, I was a freelance joke writer for them for many seasons, 6 or 7, which meant that they have staff writers for Weekend Update, and then they would also have some people outside of the office who would send in 10 jokes a week.
And are you on a retainer, or do you get paid by the joke that
we
they use?
We get paid by the joke, so it's really a labor of love.
You ever think of can you specialize in just punchlines, or you probably need to set it up too, right?
They would send us the setups, actually.
Wow.
The producer would read all the news stories and condense them to one sentences.
And then you just need to come up with like 10 punchlines, send them in, and see what you get. That's pretty cool. So how many hits you get?
Oh, not very many. I would frequently get them to dress rehearsal, which was fun because I had a friend there who did the mock-ups, and he'd be like, here was the picture for the joke that almost made it.
Well, you've got one essay that involves Jane arguing against etiquette rules. This is you. Now, you're arguing because Aunt Jane, of course, is all for etiquette. And
yes.
You're trying to say, well, you know, I'm in a different place now.
Well, that's the thing. It just doesn't apply in New York. New Yorkers don't have time for manners. They don't understand it. The one piece that they really can't wrap their heads around is the will you have some salt rule. My aunt, if she wants the salt, it's indelicate to ask for it. You're supposed to always offer something to someone else first. So she'll say to her husband, Lucius, will you have some salt? And he'll say, no, thank you. Will you have some salt? And she'd say, I'd love some salt. And then he passes it. My friends in New York are just like, what? if she moved there, she'd have to give up salt.
But you have come now to terms with these conflicting cultures.
I have. And I tried for a long time to have both. I didn't want to forsake the South, but I didn't want to leave New York. And I tried to have both. And it created this identity crisis for me a little bit. And I became very confused about who I was, and I would have to act differently depending on where I was. And there was also this third version of me, which was the me that people back home thought I was in New York because they didn't know the truth about my grungy, poor life.
You had become a lost woman.
A little bit. I as you said, I went up there to seek anonymity. I wanted to disappear. And what happened is that I was a little too good at it.
Mm-hmm. So, but was there a moment at which or a time when you actually sort of you hated your southernness? You really thought this is in my way?
I don't know that I ever hated it, but I definitely was a little embarrassed about it. I wouldn't call it shame, but I was afraid that people wouldn't understand it and that it would require so much contextualization, and it was much easier to just not talk about it. I didn't tell anybody I was a debutante. I still don't really like to tell people that. It's just hard to explain what that means, and which is not much is the short answer. But so for a long time, I held it back, and then I became ashamed that I had done that and instead began to broadcast it.
Do you have a better idea of what it means now to be Southern, having been up there?
Well, the conclusion in the book is that it's not two regions that I was choosing between, because one of those regions is where my family is, and that turns out to be a much more powerful thing than, you know, how you make your pimento cheese.
Exactly. And it's a lot cheaper just to buy that Paisley shower cap rather than buy it and ship it. So, and you can't get those in New York.
Good point.
You are getting married in June. Your fiancé lives in Chapel Hill.
Yes,
where are you going to live?
Yes. Well, that's the big cosmic joke, is that I spent 240 pages trying to figure out where I wanted to live, and I've fallen in love with an academic, so it's not up to me.
You will be almost everywhere. Thank you, Jane. Thank you so much. Wonderful book.
Thanks for having me.
Jane Borden, author of I Totally Meant to Do That. Jane Borden's going to read from her book tonight at 7 o'clock, Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. And then tomorrow night, 7:30 at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh. You can find out more if you go to janeborden.com. Borden is B-O-R-D-E-N, janeborden.com. Thank you for listening to The State of Things. If you have a comment, you can visit our website, stateofthings.org. You can check us out on Facebook. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.